It gives me great pleasure to introduce Mikey B. from Santa Maria.
Nice tie.
I'm Mikey and I'm an alcoholic. My sponsor says, where's your coat and your tie? And whatever. I've spoken before with a coat and a tie, and I'm more comfortable with this nice shirt that fits me. Put on a few pounds since then. Let's see. My story jumps around a little bit. First time I told my story, I didn't get out of the drunk-a-log part of it. So I didn't get sober in the story. So I'm going to start with getting sober. My first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous was in this very room. I sat about where Kim is right now, our visitor from Napomo. I remember, like tonight, I had to drive around the block once, one extra time, but back then I drove around about three times, trying to see if I knew anybody's car that was in the parking lot, I didn't recognize anybody's car, so I pulled in and I parked, and I came into the meeting, and I came by that window there, and I looked inside the window to see, if I knew anybody in here. I don't know, I was worried. Whatever it was, I was worried. So, at that first meeting, they do what they usually do. They do the readings. And then people started sharing. It was a participation meeting. It was a Saturday night. And it was the first Saturday of the decade of 1980. So it was January 5th. And I had gotten drunk that New Year's after being dry successfully for 2 months. And that was probably 2 months of not drinking that I hadn't been dry 2 months since I was probably about 16, consecutive. So I was really, I came in here, I had a court card. I'd gotten a couple of drunk drivings in that last summer. And I was on the court-ordered drinking driver program. And I came in here and I made sure that my court card was sticking out of my pocket so that you knew that I was not an alcoholic, that I was just here to get my court card signed because I wasn't an alcoholic at the time. But I had a lot of questions. The question that I had on my mind was, why could I not stop drinking? Why was it so hard when I was drinking to get stopped? And why did I get started? And why was I the way I was when I drank? And I listened to stories that people shared. And I left here. When I left here, I saw that very same sign right there. That sign's been up there for 46 and a half years that I know of. Keep coming back over the door. And I figured I'd be coming back at least to get the court card signed. But I left and I drove down this street here in my wrecked Pinto, which is what I was driving at the time. And I felt something odd. Just felt that there was something going on in this room, and I identify it today as hope. But back then I didn't know what to call it. So I kept coming back to some meetings. I went to about 5 meetings. I think I got the court card signed about 5 times. And then I found up some trivial reason for getting drunk, and I got drunk. And the next day, I just was convinced that I needed to give this program an honest try. And I decided that what I would do was I would not take the first drink, no matter what. I don't know if I use that kind of terminology. That's what I use today. But back then, I just decided that I wasn't going to drink, and I was going to keep coming back to these meetings, and I wasn't going to get that court card signed until those people at that program told me I had to. Because I was afraid that what would happen to me if I got the court card signed, that, and if I got the wild idea to drink, that I wouldn't come back here. I didn't trust myself. And to point out that the most important thing to me at that time and today is that the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. As far as I'm concerned, that is step zero before the 12 steps. I had to have that desire to stop drinking. I got here and I couldn't really visualize my life with alcohol, like it says in the book, and I couldn't visualize it without alcohol. What I learned here was that, and continuing coming to meetings and then up until this day, is that sobriety is possible and that it is worthwhile. Because up until that point in time, I was like the guy in A Vision for You. And I'm going to read A Vision for You. Not necessarily the last part, but the bottom of the first page. It says, now and then a serious drinker, being dry at the time, says, don't miss it at all. Feel better. Work better. Having a better time. As ex-problem drinkers, we smile at such a sally. We know our friend is like a boy whistling in the dark to keep up his spirits. He fools himself. Inwardly, he would give anything to take half a dozen drinks and get away with them. He is presently, then it talks about right there, what I said. He will presently try the old game again, for he isn't happy about his sobriety. He cannot picture life without alcohol. Someday he will be unable to imagine either life with alcohol or without it. Then he will know loneliness as few do. He will be at the jumping off place. He will wish for the end. And I loved this when I first heard it, and I was a few months when I heard it. We have shown how we have gotten under. You say, am I willing to be consigned to a life where I should be stupid, boring, and glum like some righteous people I see? I know I must get along without liquor, but how can I? Have you a sufficient substitute? Yes, there is a substitute, and it is vastly more than that. It is fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous. There you will find release from care, boredom, and worry. Your imagination will be fired. Life will mean something at last. The most satisfactory years of your existence lie ahead. Thus we find the fellowship, and so will you. I'm all throughout that. When I was dry, I was miserable. But my life got better. The situations in my life got better. But the thinking in my head didn't get better. When I came here and I heard people's sharing, before I came here, there was all kinds of people telling me what I should be doing. You know, the court system was telling me what I should do. They told me this many times. I left court and they would say, do not drink alcohol. Do not visit places where it's the chief item of sale. And there was a bunch of other things and fines and programs. Each time before the last time, I just continued doing what I'd always done, drink. You know, drink, I paid the fines, and I would drink, and I'd go to whatever classes or programs they told me to go to, and I went. But the last time that I went, I really wanted to change my life. And I found out that I needed the program. But I did not want to come here during those couple of months dry. I was working night shift at the time, and my only night off was Saturday night. Now, I'd be damned if I'll go to one of those meetings on a Saturday night. You know, that was my thinking before I got to the program. And those last two drunks helped me change my attitude. So I went to work, told my foreman, I said, hey, I need a transfer to day shift. And that was almost unheard of where I was working, because they needed, because there were so many people, that, other people that wanted to work on day shift. And I said, well, I've been having some problems with alcohol. They knew that. And I said, I need to start going to meetings. And they're at 8 o'clock at this place called the 1600 Club. Thank you. And so within a week, they transferred me to day shift. And anyway, they were supportive of me getting sober, is what they were. I'd called in a number of times, and a couple of times they'd asked me if I was drunk, and I said yes, and they said, you better not come in. And then the other times I told them I was sick. Yep. And there was a few times they sent me home. It was a machine shop and probably dangerous. But I was loaded most of the time. The job that I had, I thought that I could do it safely. Anyway, let's just go there. I started coming to AA meetings. And this one guy said he goes to meetings every night. And I was here every night that there was an AA meeting. One night a week there was an Al-Anon meeting in this room. And I was there and I was waiting for this guy to show up. And he showed up the next week. And I said, where have you been all week? And he told me that he goes to other meetings. I mean, they gave me the directory. And I just saw this place, and this is where I went. So I started going around, checking out those other meetings. And I'm not sure when they started saying 90 meetings in 90 days. When I got here, it was kind of, 90 meetings was kind of a stretch. But, you know, if you went to Napomo or San Luis Obispo or Solvang or something, it's doable. Today when I hear people say go to 90 meetings in 90 days, I like to put the deal in there, try different meetings. Because each group is autonomous. You know, it's up there in the fourth tradition. And each group has a different feel to it. I went to this room here a couple of times a week, and then over on Lincoln Street, which is now a parking lot, of the Episcopal Church, there was a house, and we called it the Little White House. And there was meetings over there too. And I went over there, and they're a little bit more loose with their meetings. You know, I was young when I got here. I forgot to mention that. I was 22 when I got here. And this meeting was kind of pretty strict, kind of. It had a set format, you know, and it just kind of, you know, but that's okay. That's good. I appreciate, a format that's got structure to it. But over there, it's kind of funny. Over here, they'd read the same things every day. They'd read chapter 3, and they'd read chapter 5, and they read the 12 traditions. Every meeting. Over at the meeting over there, they'd read How It Works, chapter 5. Sometimes they would read that part that I just read. I just read it. Now, I was here and I was interested to find out what was wrong with me. And I wanted to know what the cure was. And I looked at those steps on the wall, and of course, like it says in the big book, what an order, can't go through with it. I looked up there, and I saw all that God stuff. I was not pleased. I did not like that. And so I started reading the literature over here. The literature act was back there. So I started reading the literature. I read Too Young. That was one of the first ones that I read. Member's Eye View. You know, there was quite a few pamphlets that were interesting that I read. And I was about a month or two sober. And I've been coming to meetings here. They had a step study and they had a book study. And so I got to read a little bit of the book. But I figured I needed to get a big book. So I was out at the Orchid Lion's Den meeting. So I'm out there at the Orchid Lion's Den. And some of the people that have heard my story know what's coming next. Right? And somebody's, again, talking about, you know, they read something in the big book. And I had this thought. I thought, you know, I need to get a big book. And I I've been to this meeting a couple of times. You know, like I said, I've been there a little over a month. And so I knew that after the meeting, everybody starts talking to each other after the meeting. I figured I'd go over a literature table, pick up a big book, slide it underneath my arm, and walk off with it. Before I could do that, this old timer, the scariest of old timers, bald-headed guy, who his name's Carl. Carl Bynum. Some of you people that are old enough know who Carl Bynum is. So he later became my service sponsor. But Carl says to he says, Mike, do you need a big book? And I said, yeah. And he says, I've got a couple in the trunk of my car. So I go out there and he gives me a second edition, it's about a 1955 or 57 big book, second edition. And because he had a lot of old big books, so he gave me that. So that was my first big book. And he told me, he said, read it. He says, you know, pass it on. So later on, I bought a third edition, and then I passed on the second edition, thinking, you know, the newer one's better. Well, they didn't change the 164 pages. You know, there were some stories that changed, and they added a foreword. That's the only difference between the third edition and the second edition. So, anyway, I struggled with the God thing for a long time. When it came time to do my third step, I had to go to a family friend. And she was a good Christian lady. I used to drink with her son. And I'd go over there and I told her, I said, you know, I'm trying to get sober. And, you know, I'm having a heck of a time with the God portion of the steps. And she said she'd pray with me. And I did that. I was worried. I was, they talk about being honest, open-minded, and willing. I was willing. Open-minded. I was certainly open-minded that day to do that. Honest. I was still lying. That took a while to get straightened out. But the thing that I need to be most honest about is my drinking. I have to be honest with myself to know that I can't take so much as a sip without triggering something in my head that says, F it, I want more, because I don't have an off switch. I listened to, I don't know how long it took me to hear chapter 3 being read, which is a good thing they read it all the time, because it took me a while to understand what an alcoholic was. My first times I shared, I would say I was an unhappy drunk driver or an unlucky drunk driver, you know. And then I got really, really intellectual. I'm powerless over alcohol. I didn't have to say the word alcoholic. Powerless over alcohol. And then finally, I just said I'm an alcoholic. And today, I think about the custom that we have here in Alcoholics Anonymous is that at the beginning of a person's share, that they share that they're an alcoholic. I do that for a couple of reasons. I do that to remind myself I'm an alcoholic. I also do it so that the people in the room can identify. If there's anything that I say in my story that helps, it helps. They told me early on about the yets, because I was comparing stories. I mean, my first meeting, there was a ride to Freight Train's Wino in the room, sitting right across from me. There was another guy who's a construction worker sitting about where Ray is. He said one is too many and 1,000's not enough, or 100's not enough, whatever. But I got the point. There's a lady sitting about where Billy is, and it was Elaine. And Elaine, I didn't know her name for the longest time. I just identified her as nice lady. You know, she was just nice lady. And she talked about the loneliness of her drinking. You know, and I went to parties, and I would leave perfectly good parties because I knew that Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde personality thing was about to happen. You know, that something, I'd get the vibes. Because I had blackouts and I had personality change. For the most part, I was the good-natured slob who sat in the corner hoping to just be kind of in a coma, you know. But sometimes I would become agitated, and that's not good. And sometimes I would dismiss myself from a perfectly good party. I was always where it seemed like I was uncomfortable wherever I was at. But my whole life, when I was a kid, I got kicked out of first grade, second grade, completely expelled out of Oakley School in second grade, had to go to Cook School, which is over here. They put me in special ed because that was a behavioral problem. I was diagnosed with attention deficit disorder. And I didn't want to do any work. I wasn't interested in doing any of that stuff. I wasn't dumb. Now, I had some other learning disabilities that I later found out when I went to college after I got sober. But I didn't fit very well. When I went to the park to play ball, I couldn't throw to save my life. You know, so I wasn't picked. My younger sister was picked before I was picked. So I didn't, you know, I was good at soccer though, over here at Cook Street School. They played soccer in grade school. But when I got to junior high school, it's football. I couldn't throw a football, couldn't throw a baseball, couldn't hit a basket. I was short and fat and slow, you know, so, I managed that special ed class. They sent me to the county health services, and they gave me a prescription for Ritalin.
Yeah.
Right? There we go. Right? So, you know. So I resented the fact that they were trying to control me and medicate me. I resented it. Right? Later on, I mixed amphetamines with alcohol, you know, to... In increase the duration of the party. But I learned something in school. It was about fourth grade. I had a teacher. This teacher, she said, "Mike, would you help Sarah with her reading? And would you help Gene with his math?" And I got out of myself to help somebody else. I think this teacher knew something that I later learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, is to help people out. I didn't know that. I went through school and I didn't fit very well with my peers until I went downtown and, you know, somebody handed me a beer. That's good. Actually, my first drink that I can consciously remember was in Cub Scouts. We were in a tent. We were just south of the airport in the eucalyptus trees at a camp. There was a camp there. And we were passing the bottle around. Yeah. Burnt going down. But boy, did I feel so much different. I felt good. I felt alive. I felt that ease and comfort that is in the doctor's opinion. The doctor's opinion, I like the doctor's opinion. The doctor's opinion said that we're restless, irritable, and discontented. That's what I was as far back as I can remember as a little kid. Restless, irritable, and discontented. And it went away with alcohol. You know? And throughout my kid years until my teens, I would find out which one of my friends, right on, which one of my friends would have alcohol. And I'd ride my little stingray across town if I had to find somebody, you know, that had alcohol. My parents didn't drink, so there was no alcohol in the house. And I did that until I got a job. I got a job when I was 16. I bought a hot rod, and I started partying. What else do you do? Hot rod didn't run, so, you know, I partied a lot. But I had the car, though. So, fast forward several years. You know, I've wrecked my second car 2 times, got multiple drunk drivings, nearly killed myself in a motorcycle accident, sent to the hospital a couple of times. Once was, got in a little fight. I just got released out of the hospital from my motorcycle accident. I was supposed to be on crutches because I had cracked my pelvis open. And I also was supposed to be in a sling because I had injured my collarbone or broke it, fractured it, whatever. And instead, I'm partying at the beach and I mouth off to some guy because I was pretty wasted on pain medication and hash and whatever the heck else we were drinking that night. And I made some comment and this guy just pounded me right into the sand. And I ended up in the hospital. And I came to out of a blackout as I'm going down the hallway in the hospital. And I said to my buddy, I said, what? I just got out of the hospital 3 weeks ago. Anyway, but, you know, that was part of the end of my drinking. The last time I went to court, actually, I was in court last week for jury duty. Completely off the subject, but back then, when I went to court, it wasn't for jury duty. I was the one that was, you know, stand up there answering questions, you know, to the judge. And I got up there, and I thought you needed a lawyer to try to try to get into drinking driver school. And this was my second offense. And so I got up there and I told him, I said, well, yeah, I've got a problem. And, you know, I just want to go to, you know, drinking driver school. And so he started to ask me questions about how much money I made, how much my bills were and all this other stuff. And I lied. I told him I made less money. I told him that I had more bills. And he said, well, you still got $175 a month to where you could pay an attorney. And I go, okay, fine. So what happened was he gave me the SB 38 program, which is multiple drunk drivers are eligible for that. And I started going to program, and I started coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. And you've heard the, you've heard when I got here, and the hope that I felt when I got here. And now, I'm going to read a couple of things that helped me out in recent years that I struggled with for years. Newcomers are approaching Alcoholics Anonymous at the rate of tens of thousands a yearly. They represent almost every belief and attitude imaginable. We have atheists and agnostics. We have people of nearly every race, culture, and religion. In AA, we are supposed to be bound together in the kinship of common suffering. Consequently, the full individual liberty to practice any creed or principle or therapy, whatever, should be the first consideration for us all. Let us not, therefore, pressure anyone with our individual or collective views. Let us instead accord each other the respect and love due to every human being as he tries to make his way toward the light. Let us always try to be inclusive rather than exclusive. Let us remember that each alcoholic among us is a member of AA so long as he or she declares. Whatever you do, please do not let someone else's religious beliefs prevent you from finding the solution that is available to you through Alcoholics Anonymous. And that is a reading from the God Word pamphlet, which came out in 2020. I got sober in 1980. There was no such pamphlet. I came here a month ago, and I saw that this group has that pamphlet up there in the rack. That gave me a good feeling that this group has this pamphlet in the rack. I mentioned the pamphlets earlier, how important they were to me. I mentioned trying to steal a big book. I've bought many big books since then, and I've given away many big books since then. So I think my amends has, I've made my amends. I'm going to read a little bit of history, and then I'm going to share just some observations. Early AA in New York in 1938, there were agnostics in the Tuesday night group and several hardcore atheists who objected to any mention of God. On many evenings, Bill had to remember his first meeting with Ebby. He'd been told to ask for help from anything he believed in. These men, he could see, believed in each other and the strength of the group. At some time, each of them had been totally unable to stop drinking on his own. Yet, when two of them had worked at it together, somehow they had become more powerful and that they had finally been able to stop. This then, whatever it was, occurred between them, was what they could accept as a power greater than themselves. This reading comes from the biography for Bill W. by Robert Thompson, published in 1975 on page 255. Oddly enough, I found that in, I have the book, and it was signed with a personal note from Lois Wilson to Carl, our old timer. Carl met Lois at the San Luis Obispo Convention in 1975. He invited her. He was the speaker getter, so to speak. And, you know, she wrote that personal note to him. And then when he passed on, I inherited it So my actual, this is for you, Louisa. I loved your visual aids. She didn't use the F word once. She had a little sign with the F bomb on it. That was so cool, man. Surrender. I surrendered to this program of Alcoholics Anonymous on January 18th, 1980. For those of you wondering how many years that is, it's 46 years in January, last January. More recently, that reading that I read out of this, that I read out of this book about the atheists and the agnostics, was written by Bill Wilson in 1965. It's submitted to the Grapevine. Okay, and it's the same guy that wrote How It Works and the chapter to the agnostic. I would say that his thinking had changed at 30 years of sobriety, because he had 30 years of sobriety when he wrote that Grapevine article. But he only had just shy of 4 years when he wrote How It Works, the chapter How It Works. He finished the big book, and that was one of the last two chapters, I think, How It Works and Into Action was one of the last chapters he wrote before it got sent to the groups. More recently, Reverend Ward Ewing, non-alcoholic Class A trustee and chair of Alcoholics Anonymous General Service Board from 2009 to 2013, had this to say about the inclusiveness and keeping AA's doors open to all, including agnostics and atheists. Many in AA are atheists and agnostics, and many in AA who are atheist, agnostics, and free thinkers feel excluded. Much of the language of the Big Book and other approved literature in meetings is traditional theistic language. Certain parts of the AA literature are at best condescending towards atheists and agnostics, if downright disparaging. Yet these intrepid AAs are getting and staying sober and growing spiritually, however one might find that. The power of AA is greater than any individual person. It makes the impossible possible. I share just a little bit of this attitude. From Dr. Bob's story, Dr. Bob says, I spend a great deal of time passing on what I've learned to others and want and need it badly. I do it for four reasons. I do it as a sense of duty. It is a pleasure, because in so doing, I am paying my debt to the man who took time to pass it on to me. Because every time I do it, I take out a little bit more insurance for myself against a possible slip. Now, Alcoholics Anonymous started, if you go back to Roland Hazard, what he was talking to Dr. Carl Jung. Roland passed it on to Ebby when they met, probably through the Oxford group. And then Ebby passed it on to Bill. And then Bill passed it on to Dr. Bob. And then the members that were in this room here in January of 1980 passed it on to me. It started out as a word of mouth program. And then Bill wrote the book. And we've grown so much more than he could have imagined when he was writing this book. Now, that was a little excerpt out of Dr. Bob's story, but I'm going to also include this so that so that's something to think about. If you think you are an atheist, this is Dr. Bob, the story that he submitted for the first edition. If you think you are an atheist, an agnostic, a skeptic, or have any other form of intellectual pride which keeps you from accepting what is in this book, I feel sorry for you. I've run into kind of that attitude at times. I was a closeted agnostic for the better part of the last 30 to 35 years. I've been sober 46 years. When I came in, I was willing to try anything. Bottom line, I finally got some time. I started doing service work. I started here in this room, ashtrays. This was a smoking room when I got here. And I'll tell you, the rooms, the walls are much cleaner because they were yellow. And there was a layer of smoke. It was worse at the Lion's Den because the ceiling's low. And there was like an inversion layer of smoke like this. But I cleaned ashtrays here and coffee cups. And that's where it started. And then somebody needed an alternate secretary. Let me tell you about alternates. If you're an alternate, chances are very high that you're going to become whatever that alternate is standing in for. So I was an alternate secretary for a short period of time, and then the secretary got drunk. It happens. It happens. And I was tasked to make the coffee at the Little White House. And I was here at the Sunday meeting at 7 o'clock, this meeting. And we had a meeting over there, just three blocks over there, at 8:30. And I was the alternate secretary of that group. And I was sitting back, I was sitting in this room here. And somebody came in and said, "Mike, you got to go over and make coffee. Here's the keys. Chuck got drunk." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "You know, Chuck's drunk. You're the secretary now." So I went over there. I left here. I was here early before the meeting started. I left here. I went over there. I started the coffee. I came back here and I got part of the meeting in. I went back over there to open up the meeting for the people to show up. My current sponsor, Ray, he was the first person to show up over there, probably with his wife, Helga. They show up over there. Ray goes over and says, "Is the coffee ready?" And I said, "I don't know. Does that red light mean something?" It's one of those 30 cuppers. And he goes over and he takes a drink of coffee. And what happened, Ray? He spit it out in the sink because nobody trained me on how to make coffee. And I made coffee like I made drinks. It was going to be strong because I don't want anybody saying I made weak coffee. You know, so, yeah. But, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous has been good to me. And over the years, I've struggled with what's my higher power? What's my higher power? If I don't believe in God, what's my higher power? I group of drunks, you know, that worked for years. You know, just that idea. I didn't even have to say it, you know, just that idea. And, you know, I struggled a couple years ago, and Kathy gave me a book, you know, Waiting, you know. And so I read that book 2.5 times, and I didn't get my answer because everybody's answer is different. You know, everybody's higher power is different. You know, so that's where it's at, you know. But for me, it's the power of the fellowship. It's the power of one drunk talking to another drunk. And I got one more thing in here. There's always one more thing. There's a lot of good stuff in the big book. I mean, you know, I may put down chapter 4 because it doesn't speak to the agnostic. Because when Bill wrote that, he still thought that we really needed to get his God as he understood him. And then Jim Burwell and Hank Parkhurst said, you know, as you understood him, or as we understood him. So that was a compromise made. Bill wrote the majority of the book, but you know, it had to be approved by the group. And the group said, you know, so the atheist and agnostic wing of the Alcoholics Anonymous at the time said, you know, they didn't want any of the God. And Bill left all the God in there. But he changed it, you know, to say, as we understood him. Right, so that was a compromise made. And the other compromises made in the book was the original step 7 was on your knees. If you get a copy of the original transcript of the big book, the original seventh step was to be done on your knees. And they also put in the steps are suggested, which are suggested as a program of recovery. So, and I'm going to close with this. Working with others, you know, our 12th step. You know, it's the bedrock of our program. Because I can't do it by myself with just myself. And if somebody handed me a big book, it wouldn't work. But without, I got these rooms. The rooms were here when I got here. And I hope they stay here. Chapter 7, working with others. Practical experience shows that nothing so much as ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works when other activities fail. This is our 12th suggestion. Carry this message to other alcoholics. Life will take on new meaning to watch people recover, to help others, to watch loneliness vanish, and to see a fellowship grow about you, to have a host of friends. This is an experience you must not miss. And then it says, frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is a bright spot in our lives. And I have found that to be true. And this was a Grapevine article. This was great. Last summer's Grapevine. It was August. And it has several stories submitted by non-believers. My home group is the Los Alamos group. That's my AA home group. And my secular home group is in San Luis Obispo, Agnostics and Others. And we do things a little different. The readings are a little different. And we do not close in prayer. But the rest of the sharing is everybody's, you know, experience, strength, and hope. Their story. Thanks.
Yeah, bless you.
All right, let's give Mikey another round of applause.